Accession number 30285.
John Dixon, Reel 1. John, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Yes, I was born in Cardiff in October of 1922.
And what about your family? What did your father do for a living?
My father was a marine engineer and sailed out of Cardiff when I was a child, of course, for many years, and became a chief engineer and served throughout the Second World War as a chief engineer.
What about the family home? What was that like?
I can't remember anything about where I was born, because we left there when I was about three, and moved away from the docks area of Cardiff, Tiger Bay, in fact, and Loudon Square. And then we went to a part of Cardiff which was to the north, far away. And that's where I grew up, really, in one of the residential areas of Cardiff.
Any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have two sisters and one brother.
And what about your early education? What was that?
Very brief. I left school when I was 14, for some reason. Then I spent a year at the Cardiff Technical College, and then I went to work in the solicitor's office from school. And apart from that, I waited for the war, of course, came when I was 16. So I just waited to volunteer for the RAF.
Had you had any interest in aviation when you were younger?
Not particularly, no. I knew very little, actually. I knew more about the Navy and the Army than I did about the RAF.
Did you volunteer as air crew?
Yes, that's right, in 1940.
Was there any reason for that, as opposed to, say, the Navy?
Yes, I think I was fascinated by a lot of the publicity that the recruiting people, the posters that displayed bombers in the nightlife with its searchlights and fighter pilots, and I thought this was much better than being caught in a trench somewhere. So I decided that the blue was the place to be, perhaps get away from it.
Had the Navy ever got any consideration?
Well, of course, I'd been closely involved with the Merchant Navy, visiting my father in the various places that he arrived back in the UK. So I was quite at home with the Navy in those terms, but it didn't appear to me as a service to join.
During the late 1930s, how aware were you of the situation in Europe?
Very aware, yes. Yes, very aware. And when I was about, I suppose, about 15, 16, I remember we used to discuss what was happening. And particularly, of course, with Chamberlain and his visit to Hitler. And it was quite, seemed to us that we were going to be called up sooner or later. And in fact, that did occur, as you know, in 1938, was it 39, when conscription was introduced. So one could see that would happen eventually.
So you felt that you would be part of this coming war?
Yes. Well, that was inevitable, I thought, yeah.
Can you remember the declaration of war?
Yes, I can. I can. I remember listening to Chamberlain's speech where he announced that because we hadn't received any response to the message that we'd sent to Hitler about our requirements, that the war would commence, I think, was it 11 o'clock on that day? Yes, I remember that.
And how did you feel about that when you heard that?
I thought we'd done the right thing. I think I felt very strongly about what had taken place. I always have, because I'm fond of history. And so I followed very closely, and I thought we were doing the right thing.
What about the rest of your family? How did they feel?
Well, my father was away, of course. My mother didn't say too much. My brother and one of my sisters were much younger than I was. And so I just left them. That was that. And, of course, we'd been heavily bombed in Cardiff.
Yeah, I was wondering prior to that, what were the first kind of manifestations of the war after the declaration that occurred? Is there anything that sticks in your mind as, say, the introductions of new restrictions or that type of thing?
I remember the bombing mostly, and I'd paid a visit to London during the Blitz period. Not quite sure what the reason was, but I found myself up there when it was being heavily bombed, and that was really my first involvement with any aspect of the war other than reading about what went on.
What was that experience like visiting London when that was occurring?
It was pretty bad. It was very bad and very impressionable, and of course as a young boy or a teenager, with the street torn up and the great craters here and there and all that horror going down there. I didn't stay there long. I think I only stayed, probably overnight.
And what about Cardiff? Because Cardiff was bombed as well, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, and I was there. And that may, in fact, have edged me along a bit and wanted to retaliate. But my own house was damaged in an attack, one night attack, and we were evacuated out of our home. Went to a school in the district where they looked after us until a landmine, I think it was, that hadn't exploded and near to the house. And so until they did, they took us away. That would be late 1940.
Did you have a shelter at home?
Yes. Yes, we had one of the Anderson shelters. But my father was never there, of course. That was a great problem. And I don't know how we managed, but we popped in and out of this Anderson shelter when necessary. And then they also, if you recall, in another raid, I lived near Llandaff. And that's when they damaged the cathedral there, which is not far away from us. And we eventually went back to the house after the mine exploded. And it got caught up in a tree or something.
Was there much damage to the house?
No, not a great deal. Cracks and things in the ceilings and minor things, really, rather.
How intense was the bombing? How often would the Germans come over?
There weren't all that many major raids, but they were quite intense when they did come. They were always night raids, of course, although we used to have the odd German aircraft doing wreckages around the docks and all that sort of thing. The major raids were at night and quite large scale and widespread over the city.
Yeah, did there seem to be anywhere that they were targeting, or did it just seem at the time to be the city itself?
Well, we wondered why they were. We were experienced bombing from where we live, which was quite on the northern edge of Cardiff, in a totally residential area, not even light industry there. And it was puzzling why they were dropping bombs around there. But it may have been because the railways were running through and not too far away, so perhaps they were bombing there.
And you mentioned that there's an element there of you wanting to retaliate. How did that manifest itself with you?
I think it was to do with the fact that I felt I needed to join the RAF as soon as possible and see whether I could get involved.
Were you involved at all during 1940 in anything like the Home Guard or the ATC?
Yes. I listened to the broadcast about that initiation of the local defence volunteer that we were, and I was told to report to the local police station if I wanted to join, which I did. So from, I wonder when, it would be June, wouldn't it? Yeah, if we started. And then I stayed with the Home Guard until I went into the RAF. And I was also on manning a roadblock when we got that fictitious announcement, if you remember, that the paratroopers had dropped somewhere. I don't think I could have broken an eggshell in those days.
When you joined the Home Guard, was it still the local defence volunteers?
Yes.
How were you equipped initially?
All we had was we had the Ross 300 rifle, which I think had come from Canada to replace all our equipment which we'd left in France. So when we manned up, that's all we had was these 300 Ross rifles.
And at the time, had you been issued with a uniform?
We had a uniform. Mm. Yes, a sort of ghastly denim-looking thing. I do recall having a picture taken, and I looked pretty ghastly.
What sort of insignia would you wear?
I didn't have any yet, don't you? In fact, I had to write away after the war to find out what unit I was with. It was the 10th Battalion of the Army unit, the Glamorgan Infantry.
And how often would you meet with the Home Guard? What would your duties entail normally?
Well, it was mostly training, and then they put us on various places to guard for road junctions that were near to where we were actually billeted, and the headquarters was in a castle at St. Fagans, and so we manned up the roads round in the area, particularly junctions.
And what would your duty be there? Would it be to stop vehicles, or would it just be to watch for anything that was suspicious or out of the ordinary?
That's right. We were told to keep an eye open for anybody that tried to move around us or through the roads.
And what would you roadblock him? What would it be?
I can't remember. I think it was some physical obstacles we put across the road. And then we had a tent located just adjacent in the fields, overlooking the area, so we could monitor what was taking place.
With your training, how often would you meet, though? How would it be once a week, once a month?
It was once or twice a week. Yeah, and we stayed up at the headquarters overnight, and then we were released in the morning.
And what did your training entail?
The usual infantry-like training, I suspect. The use of arms and making petrol bombs so that we could throw them at any tanks or vehicles.
Oh, how did you make them?
It was out of petrol with a wick. And they were Molotov cocktails, weren't they? And we made those, that was part of our kit. That if there was any trouble, we would hurl these bottles at things.
Did you have any practice throwing them?
No. No. We were told, we were shown how to make them and what we expected to do with them and how to use them and the best way to use them. And I remember that.
What was the size of the unit?
I think it was a battalion strength, which is a battalion's about 1,000 men. Yes. Around about that, so we must have been part, obviously, of a local battalion.
Was that spread out all over the city then, or?
I suspect that would be in the northern area.
And what were the types of people who were in the Home Guard? Because obviously, people see a lot of Dad's Army, but how was your unit made?
They were really marvellous. Most of them were veterans from the First World War, and they introduced us into the difficulties of playing brag. And other things. So they kept us up at night, just teaching us how to play cards. And then immediately opposite to St. Fagans Castle, there is a local pub, which apparently was very popular with people.
Was the majority of the unit made up of First World War veterans, or was there a smattering of younger people like yourself?
No, I don't think it was the majority, but there were quite a number. Quite a number. And we were trained as a platoon, but by these chaps.
During that period that you were with them, were there any introductions of any other weapons into the unit?
Not that I'm aware of. There was a desperate shortage of problems. We handed over to each other the weapons when we manned, we used to man the entrance gates to the headquarters, that sort of thing, and that we took over the arms from the guards.
How successful do you think the Home Guard would have been if they'd have been put to the test of fighting the Germans?
Not very effective. think, in those very, I'm talking about the LDB, very early days, where we were trying to sort things out and create things and how we were going to deal with the problem. So it was a bit, asking a bit too much from young boys and old men, relatively, to fight the sort of thing they would have to look forward to again.
How useful do you think the experience of being with the Home Guard was for your later military service?
Yeah, I think it was very good. I think it was very good because I noticed that when I went into the RAF, when they knew that I'd been in a military unit up until then, I tended to find that I would become the leading man.
How did you go about joining the RAF?
I went to my local recruiting office, which was in Frederick Street in Cardiff in those days, and did the initial interview, and they then sent me to Oxford, where the Aircrew Selection Board was set up for Southern England.
What did that initial interview really encompass? What were they asking?
All of the usual petty things that you fill up with form, your name and address and age, and there's questions like that.
Did you have to volunteer for aircrew?
Yes, there were no conscript aircrew. Every individual aircrew had volunteered.
And were you sure that that's the thing that you definitely wanted to do at that stage?
No question, yes. Yes, I'm very convinced. I would have been bitterly disappointed. And I'd been doing some studying and refreshing on maths and all sorts of little things like that before I went up to the Aircrew Selection Board at Oxford.
And what role did you maybe envisage yourself at that time?
Well, I had hoped to be a pilot, and then that was my target. I didn't know too much about other things. And then when I went to Oxford, of course, I had to have an aircrew medical.
What's that?
It introduced various tests that you wouldn't normally have, blowing up things and measuring pulses and heartbeats and eyesight particularly. And unfortunately, they discovered that I lacked visual acuity, as they put it, in my right eye. And they said that barred me from becoming a pilot.
How did you feel about that at the time?
I was terribly, terribly upset. And a lot of the lads who were there with me, all young people, of course, some of them were being failed because of colour blindness and that sort of thing. But then they said to me, but we can offer you the position of wireless operator air gunner, because they wouldn't accept me as an observer because of this failing in the right eye, which incidentally I've never been able to discover what it is. And when I ask oculists and things, they just look at me more and less blankly, and they say, don't understand why they did that. So I never have understood whether there wasn't some subversive motive behind it, because they were sorting out people, and for some branches they weren't getting the number of people for. And I only heard about this quite recently. I don't know how true it is.
Well, I was wondering if that was the case, that because you said quite a few people maybe failed with colour blindness, that obviously the number of recruits, would you say the majority of the people that you were with at that selection wanted to be pilots?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. No question about that. And we knew, well, I now know that there were obviously a lot of people who were volunteering for piloting, and already the training chain was blocked. And since then, I've given it a bit of thought, and I do really wonder whether they were filtering and then offering posts where they weren't getting people to volunteer. Maybe true. I've no evidence, but that may be the case.
What did you have to do after the selection? Did you have to return home after a period of time of deferment?
Well, the first thing I did, of course, was that they took me into the RAF in terms of giving me a number. But it was coming up towards Christmas of 1940, and I just turned 18, and they said to me, perhaps you'd like to stay at home until Christmas, and we'll call you to the service after Christmas. I wasn't particularly concerned about that, but somehow or another again. I now know the reason for that, which I didn't then. And I said, yeah, well, that's all right. I'll go. So they said, go back home and we'll call you into uniform after Christmas. And
what,
that's what
they did. What was the reasoning then?
The training machine was blocked, thoroughly blocked, as I found out a bit later on. And there were long delays because, of course, the Empire, the Commonwealth Air Training Scheme, was not in being. The RAF in 1940 was trying to expand at a rate the facilities didn't allow them to deal with the numbers that were coming forward. And so they had a built-in block of training until the Commonwealth schemes opened up and we started to get people coming from Canada and Australia. But in those days, that wasn't the case.
What was your impressions of the RAF that you gained over the you know, what you'd heard about what they'd done during 1940? At that stage, what did you think you might end up doing with them? What did you think about their performance? That sort of thing.
Well, I thought when I accepted this post as Wireless Operator Air Gunner that I would be one of a bomber crew, and that the job I would be doing would be bombing Germany. I think that's what I had in mind.
And the understanding at the time, what was Bomber Command doing? Were you aware of the types of operations that they were involved in?
Well, other than that, which propaganda had told us that was going on, which of course was a lot of rubbish, total and utter rubbish. Very unfortunate, but it was all rubbish. It was the delays in the training schedule that were upsetting.
What happened in January then? What was the next stage for you?
I was sent to Blackpool to do my initial entrance training as a raw recruit into the RAF, and I was there from the January, I think it was to March.
Where were you accommodated?
In the boarding houses. That time there, we were in a boarding house in South Shore, just alongside the prom there. Bitterly, bitterly cold, and so on. And we trained on the promenade. And that was it.
What did the training entail at that stage?
Of course, the usual drill training. A lot of that. And then we were trained in the use of firearms, grenades, and bayoneting things, and that type of military operation, and inoculations, and a variety of things.
How did you take to that kind of basic training?
I loved it. I loved it. It didn't worry me in the slightest. And they made me head boy of the flight. So it was all right. Yes, I did very well.
What was the reason for you being made head boy of the flight, was that?
Well, I think it must have been because I was a Home Guard man who was used to handling weapons with my limited ability. So they put me, it was quite interesting because it was destined to be midwinter, and I was appointed to carry a torch, a lamp, in front of the flight as we marched around the A to B in Blackpool from one place to another. And I would lead them with my lamp so that we weren't run over by cars and things, something like that.
Did everybody adjust at that stage to the kind of basic training?
I never experienced any great problems with the people we had. They were all aircrew, by the way. Pilots, navy observers, and wireless operators and signal. So they're all aircrew.
How much does that affect their outlook, would you say, that they are volunteer aircrew?
The morale was very high, very high, and they were a great bunch, marvellous bunch of chaps, really wonderful.
How keen was everybody to get onto operations? Was it something that you really wanted to do?
Yes, couldn't get on with the job, really, and that's why we were unaware, we weren't told that we would experience these problems, and so when we finished our training at Blackpool, we assume that we will be sent on our respective training courses. And so we were all getting ready for where we would be sent to start. In fact, what happened, we were sent to Tanga, which, as you know, is a renowned fighter airfield near Chichester. And we I think about 20 of us ended up there, a mixed bag of pilots and observers and wireless operator, of which we're under training, wearing our little white flashes in our hats, which we were very proud of. And then the pilots left first, having waited about 3 to 4 months to get onto their training machine and into it. The same didn't apply to us. They held us there another couple of months. And I didn't leave Tangmere until August of 1941.
What were your duties while you were at Tangmere?
That's extremely interesting, I think. My first job, I was told by the flight sergeant in charge of, because we'd been posted to 219 Squadron, which was flying light fighter, both fighters, operationally, of course. And the flight sergeant, when he interviewed me, said that I was being given the job of keeping the airman's accommodation clean, including the bathroom and so on. So my first job was washing floors and keeping things in order. So that certainly brought us down to earth very quickly. And then that didn't last too long, and we were being bombed at the time. They then said that we were now to join the flare path party, which was provided by the squadron in terms of personnel. And that became very interesting, because we had to a proportion of duty in the evening after supper, and then we'd spend all night on the airfield. We would set up the telephone communication by hauling out from a big wheel, the landline, to get the messages back from the runway, or the duty pilot would phone us to put on the translate. We towed out a translate, positioned it on the end of the runway when the aircraft landed, and then the duty pilot would phone us and tell us to switch it on and switch it off. So we would spend our nights on operating on watch duties, being relieved after every couple of hours or so. Out on the end of the runway throughout the night. And then at the other end, the far end of the runway from where the aircraft were landing, we used to put what they called a teepee, which consisted of a somewhat antiquated four-wheeled vehicle, which we towed out at the back of the lorry. And it had a T-piece structure standing on it with some lights. And when an aircraft was landing, we were instructed to wire up the battery and put the lights on to tell the pilot that he was reaching the end of the runway. and one night I was standing there when I saw the floodlight come on and knew that there was an aircraft landing. And I heard it touch down, and it seemed to come closer and closer, and I thought, that sounds very near. And in fact, it was out of control, and it flashed past me. Right on the perimeter of the airfield. And there was a lot of barbed wire there. And so the pilot went right into the barbed wire lot. And immediately behind the barbed wire was a little country road. So he jumped over the road, trailing all the barbed wire behind him onto the other side of the road. I couldn't get to the pilot because of all the barbed wire and stuff. Difficult to get across there. Anyway, people on the other side of the road, where there were some quarters, got there before I got there, and the pilot was all right, and I got him out, and that was that. The other problem about being there was that when they were attacking the airfield at night, these small rays penetrating